Thank you for joining us. Welcome to our quarterly conference call. I'm David Rothberg, and with me is Al Friedberg. Good morning, Al. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, David. Fine.
Good. Today is April 25th. A little bit of housekeeping to begin. We're going to try and speak between 30 and 40 minutes, and we're going to respond to questions that have already been sent to us by clients. If you have questions during the course of the call, please feel free to email them to me at drothberg@niagaracapital.ca or to Eddie Roth if you have his email handy, erot@niagaracapital.ca. You can even text them to me if you like. I'll give you my cell. It's 416-993-4160. Okay, Al, I think that covers it. One last thing. If you need to drop out early, we post the call both on the Friedberg website and on the Niagara website, and you'll get notice of it within a short period after we finish the call. Okay, let's get to it. Al, first question.
Yes.
Comes from an investor who notes that, you know, last quarterly, he gets the sense that you're very constructive about the future, and it's uncharacteristic relative to your history. You believe that the next few months at least will be favorable to investment assets in general. And yet the news background is gloomy. Prospects, at least judged in a conventional way, appear to be uncertain. And you're asked here, to express in different words, the fear of being redundant, to give a background to your generally upbeat attitude.
Well, yes, the background is certainly very blasé. We have gridlock in Washington. We have all kinds. We have elections in Europe that are always on the border of maybe going the wrong way. We have problems in China. It's true that the background is not great, but I think that the main forces operating in on these investment markets is the fact that we have a strong gathering upswing throughout most of the world. In other words, for instance, the Eurozone now is growing. The U.S., even though it's not growing rapidly, but it's growing. So Japan is growing. So we have a synchronized upswing around the world. And seems to be well-based. We don't have any great excesses. Where we had excesses, they seem to be now they seem to be correcting. There are some areas, for example, auto sales in the U.S., we had some excesses. It is correcting now on its own. So on the one hand, we have the synchronized upswing, which is an ideal situation. And the other thing that's very, very important, the second element, and that's extremely important, is the fact that we have repressed interest rates. In real terms, interest rates remain extremely low. In real terms, we're dealing with real rates of perhaps I don't know, based on governments, maybe 0.5% a year. So they're historically very, very low, and so that makes the ownership of investment assets, whether it's stocks or even real estate, attractive, very attractive, and basically investors have nowhere to go. So it's an ideal background, and whatever it's happening in the background, what else is happening in the background is noise, a lot of noise. So we think that we need to ignore all the chatter talk about possible recessions and about the fact that the tax reform is not coming this year. It may come next year. It may never come. All that I think should be set back and not be considered at the moment. The important thing is an economic upswing, synchronized, and very low real interest rates, or and in fact prospects for continued low interest rates too, because the Fed is moving very, very slowly. We don't even know, and I don't think that they know how fast they will be moving. And so for the next 6 months, we see clearly upswings ahead for all investment assets.
there's a this is the fundamental background, but from a technical point of view, I mean, by that I mean if you look in conventional metrics, price earnings ratio, moving at the ratio of new highs to new lows, the proximity of many markets to or beneath their 50-day moving averages, to take a bullish position here in a way positions you in that dangerous strata. So it seems to me of those people who say this time it's different. Is this time it's different? Is it different this time? You not worry about that?
Well, we're not saying that. We're not unqualifiedly bullish. I mean, the portfolio is net long. We have some short positions. We began to short some retailers in the U.S., which is almost like a no-brainer. For many of these retailers are just sinking very rapidly, even when they're taking protection, closing stores and going electronic. I mean, they destroyed. But there are sectors in markets that are well priced, and I think that this is where you have to be. So, the valuation problem is, in our view, not a major issue. We have said this before. We look at the difference between earning yields and real yields and on bonds, and we see them to be still wide, still attractive in favor of stock prices. You're right that they're always clouds and they're always little problems, but the main forces remain bullish underneath these markets.
I think for a long time, or the last several months at least, I think the general consensus has been that the Fed would not raise rates because in a consumption-led economy, equity rather than income has become the determinant for consumer purchases. So the Fed is very reluctant to raise rates for fear that they're going to damage assets. Apparently, close to 30% now of consumer balance sheets are invested in equity securities. The same effect of rising rates would probably imperil real estate values as well. So the general consensus was that you had a free put. But recently, there's a hot paper that was circulated. I'm sure you read it in the last week that argues that the zero bound rate has created enormous misallocations of capital and has really, in effect, kind of created a perverse loop that in its own way, over the long term, is a wealth destroyer rather than a wealth creator. As that kind of thinking starts to permeate, it's very possible now that rates might rise, or let's say that the odds of rising rates have increased a bit. What would the effect on the economy of an interest rate be should the Fed begin to shrink its balance sheet? Specifically, like what would be the estimated rise in real long-term rates from the Fed not repurchasing expired Treasury securities? This is a question I'm quoting now from the investor. Or how much shrinking of the balance sheet would need to take place to equate a 25 basis point rate increase? And what would happen if that were to occur?
Well, you know, that's the question, and you have to believe that, and this has been the case before. It's a lot easier to lower rates than to raise rates, and the Fed is a political animal, and it's going to be difficult for them to do it. I mean, even the idea of shrinking the balance sheet, which is a huge, a $4 trillion balance sheet, there's already economists and good economists who are saying we shouldn't be shrinking the balance sheet because, we need the liquidity provided by these securities, right, and repo operations and so on. So there's going to be a lot of pushback on this idea of shrinking the balance sheet. It's going to take a long time. It's going to be very difficult to do. Certainly not in the next 6 months. And our horizon is usually a 6 months year, and we don't see any major shrinkage in that period of time. Will it happen later? I believe that the only time it will happen, and the only time that the Fed will get serious, is, and this is by looking back at history, is when they actually see accelerating inflation. There, we're not at this stage of accelerating inflation. Inflation is sort of still running around 2% a year or so. There was a little bit of a spurt because of oil prices, but now it's sort of quieted down. So I'd say that unless you get inflation to accelerate, you will not see the Fed take an aggressive posture in this market. The Fed is not, contrary to what you're saying now in this paper, the Fed is not looking at a misallocation of resources. That is a serious long-term problem. That is a fact that we have misallocated resources. And the price to pay for that will be in the future. It will take time. It will happen. But for now, I think the Fed's only reaction will be to accelerating inflation. And I don't think we have anything to worry about them tightening, quote unquote, too much.
Well, also, would not rising inflation, especially at its earliest stages, be beneficial to a long position?
Yeah, it would, and that's why I think that this is really a sweet spot for us. You have everything going for you. You have the economic upswing, which has an impact on earnings. You have repurse rates, and then you have maybe the beginnings of an acceleration in inflation. We haven't seen it yet. By the way, we are long and we are betting on that because we are long commodity prices through an index, the Bloomberg Index. But we haven't seen any real strength there. A bit puzzling, but maybe we can discuss it later. But the fact of the matter is that we have a very good handle on whether we're going to see that accelerating inflation. And so far, there's no signs of that happening.
Let's talk about commodity prices a bit. It's one of the questions that's come up. They have been subdued. You've committed about 30% of your capital betting on higher prices. I think that's both in the asset allocation fund and the global macro fund. It's not just by owning the Bloomberg Commodity Index. You also have a long position in the global macro fund via your allocation to the CTA. Who manages your book from the long side, and you're also long some gold and silver. What's going on there? What's your thinking there?
Well,
if they're so subdued, and you're so, you know, nothing's
funny.
Happening.
It's funny. Just in the last few days, we looked for instance at the Bloomberg Index of commodity prices, and you know there are a number of different indices. There's the CRB index, and there's other indices too, and the difference between one index and the other index is the weight allocated to each commodity, and how do you decide? What is the methodology behind it?
Right.
How much weight do you allocate to oil or to natural gas or to copper? So, I can't get into that question. I think it's a complicated question. Bloomberg, an index, and seems to be the most traded of all the indices. They're based on the economic significance of these commodities and also on the liquidity that these futures provide. And so it's sort of a mix between the real world and the paper world, let's say, and which is easy to trade and which we've been trading. Their index, incredibly enough, is today in nominal terms at the same level as it was in 1993. So we're talking about 25 years ago. The commodity index is at the same level as it was in 1993. In real terms, if you adjust for CPI, you're down 50%. Prices are down 50% in real terms. It tells you that they're not expensive. It tells you that they're cheap. Of course, we know that over time, commodity prices in real terms do decline. Make sure that that's what happens. You get more and more output per dollar, but yet the decline in real terms is very, very substantial. And not only is the decline very substantial in real terms, but just recently, and I'm talking about I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, that same index was trading I'm just going to give you a number, like 235 as an index. That was at the peak of 2008. It's today trading at 85.
2011.
There's been a huge decline in index. And now, by the way, it's not just oil, because oil only represents about 20-25% in total of the index. So there's 40 commodities there. So if you can make an argument that today commodities are perhaps the cheapest asset available. It's not an investment asset, right? It's not an investment asset. To make it an investment asset, it would have to produce income. But it is an asset of sorts, and it is probably the cheapest one that you can find today. The missing ingredient is momentum. It doesn't have yet the momentum. It hasn't yet shown enough of the momentum to rise. And we have had some great crops, great production in the grains, which has affected the market. We have had this huge increase in oil, the frackers. In many sectors, we have had increases in production that have affected. But we would expect that at some point, increase in money that has taken place in China, in the U.S. over the past 10 years, you would expect that some of that money would begin to affect commodity prices. And so they're cheap. Yes, they're very, very cheap. Do they have a momentum? Not yet. And we need momentum. And so we are watching it very closely. We will abandon the position if we don't see momentum, although we don't see much risk either. But we will abandon the position if we don't see upside momentum. And this is what we're waiting for. And, of course, upside momentum in commodity prices tells you what will happen to interest rates, what will happen to the Fed, and so on and so forth. So it's an important, it's a very significant position in that it alerts us also to other things that may happen in the market.
Let's talk just briefly about momentum. Momentum is often considered a key ingredient in global macro in general, and in its kissing cousin, CTAs. It's also very closely related to volatility, which is at historic lows. What do you think is happening there? Why do you think there's been so little momentum that can be culled by global macro players? Why is there generally no momentum, not just in commodity markets, but in equity markets as well?
Is the question, why is there low volatility?
Well, the question is where is the momentum gone? Why is there no momentum? I'll repeat. I'm sorry if I wasn't well heard. Generally speaking, global macro, a key component of the success of global macro is generally considered to be momentum, and there hasn't been much momentum.
Well,
you're talking about momentum in commodity prices. I mean, in asset prices generally, where's the momentum?
Right,
do you have any
right.
thoughts about that?
And I would disagree partially. I would say that there is momentum in some markets. I mean, you have had momentum in the 10 most actively traded stocks in the S&P or in NASDAQ, Amazon's and Google's and so on. They've had upside momentum,
true,
a lot of upside
true.
Momentum.
True.
So, and you had upside momentum in real estate, for example, New York City and San Francisco real estate up until 6 months ago. You had tremendous upside momentum. So there is some momentum in some areas. It has not been generalized. There is budding momentum, for example, and that is happening in the U.S. housing market. I'm not talking about Toronto. Toronto has had incredible momentum in the past 3 years or 4 years. But even the U.S., you have had a sort of an increase of about 0.5%, 0.75% a month in house prices. So there is some momentum, some upside momentum in some areas. It's not generalized. Volatility, which is something a little different, is been more subdued, and probably most of it, the fact that it's subdued, is a good part of it has to do with the fact that, you know, central banks have intervened and have smoothed with all their interventions. It continues because you still have QE in Europe, you still have QE in Japan, and that affects all markets. So, yes, there is upside momentum in some areas. It's not generalized. We want to see that happening in commodity prices. We think it will happen. And I think it's just a matter of waiting.
You mentioned home builders. You have a rather outsized exposure in home builders, both in the global macro and the asset allocation fund. And typically, home builders are considered to be most robust at the early stages of an economic cycle. I think it would be hard to argue that we're in an early stage of an economic cycle. Is it the momentum in prices that is keeping you there?
The momentum in prices is telling us that we have a very low inventory of houses, and I think that the numbers indicate that we are at about 4 months supply, given today's rate of sales. 4 months supply. 4 months supply is the lowest we've seen, and I believe the lowest we've seen in our recorded history, at least going back 20 or 30 years, anyway. So there's very little inventory. Therefore, there is rising price, and that rising prices tells you that that's what's happening. And therefore, the stage is set for these home builders to build and sell and build and increase inventory. So, as an example, today, I think Pulte this morning, one of the big builders, that their backlog of orders increased like 14%. Interestingly, half, if you look at it from the point of view of unit sales, it's half unit sales and half prices are rising 6 to 8% a year, and the other half is unit sales. We're going to need a very large increase in supply to satisfy this demand, and that should do very well for the home builders. And they're not selling expensively. I think that that's one sector that is not selling. It's not expensive, and it's at a discount to the S&P PE ratios. Generally speaking, cyclical companies do trade at a discount to this S&P, but I believe that they are not cyclical today. Seeing what's happening in terms of inventory, seeing what's happening in the availability of housing, I believe that this is an industry that for the next probably 3 to 5 years will continue to build and sell houses profitably for 3 to 5 years at least.
Okay, let's switch gears from domestic to foreign. You've got a small position in Greek banks. It's around 7% of capital. At the same time, as we spoke last at our last conference call, you talked about putting on positions that will only have an impact on the NAV, and I think that your basic benchmark there was 10%. How can such a small position square with that kind of objective?
Right. Well, to explain again, and I think you're right. You said it right. We have moved to a situation where we now decided that the only positions that we will have, that we will take on, are positions that can, at the very least, increase net asset value by 10% of the fund's net asset value. So they have to be material, and that keeps us very focused on trades that we have conviction on, and where we think that there is a large upside potential. So the question is a good question. Greek banks only represent 7% of the fund, so they would have to rise by a large multiple in order to give us that material gain. And the answer is yes, we do expect that to happen. The Greek banks are selling today somewhere between 20 and 25 cents of book value. So they're selling extremely cheap. They're much cheaper, for example, than European banks that are selling at the moment around 70 cents, 80 cents of book value. So we believe that as Greece nears a settlement again with its creditors, and I believe they will, they have to. They don't really have much of a choice. Neither the creditors nor the debtors have a choice in this matter. One way or the other, they have to come to an agreement. The Greek government has made some strides. For example, they are running at the moment a surplus X interest of 1.5% of GDP. The IMF and the creditors wanted to run a surplus of 3.5% so that they can pay down the debt more rapidly. It's not going to be possible. But at 1.5%, they have made some strides. They have privatized some things, not as much as we wanted. They are taking some very hard decisions when it comes to pensions, and they are cutting pensions again. It's a very painful decision for them and for the population. But they are moving in that direction. In the meantime, the banking sector is repairing its balance sheet, looking better all the time, and selling at 20, 25 cents a book. It tells us that, you know, we have here something that can move to 50 or 75% of book in not a very long time. So if you say if you agree, then you're talking about a material position, because that can become a 10 or 15% gain for the fund.
What are Canadian banks selling at? Like
Canadian banks over two times, I think. I haven't seen them lately, but they're a lot more expensive. Canadian banks must be the most expensive ones in the world.
You're essentially long, or you're biased towards the long side in the Global Macro Fund in a way that prior to last year you haven't been. In the Asset Allocation Fund, it's a long-only fund. You don't give yourself permission to be short or to assume any leverage. And yet, despite being long, your correlations to the S&P are relatively low. In the Global Macro, they've been, over the past several months, 0.4, and I think in the Asset Allocation Fund, 0.3. How have you managed to pull that off? It's like a rabbit coming out of a hat.
Long, but we do have other exposure and other positions that even though they move in the same type of direction, they're investment asset friendly, let's call it that way, but they don't necessarily move together at the same time. Also, we especially in the Global Macro Fund, we've had positions like put options in certain markets that will move contrary to the to the general trend of the market, and commodity prices themselves have not moved in the same direction as investment assets. So there is some offset to those positions, and it doesn't necessarily have that. That's the reason why the even though we have a positive correlation in both funds to the S&P, but it's not very high. It's not extremely high.
0.4 and 0.3. I mean,
yeah.
Especially
yeah.
In the asset
and like
allocation.
And like to keep small. It that way too. Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about the Global Macro, the positions about the Global Macro Fund that are different than the ones you have in the Asset Allocation Fund. But let's talk a bit first about the Asset Allocation Fund. You have there a lower exposure in commodities than you do in the Global Macro Fund, but you're much more largely exposed to gold via gold miners and silver bullion. And you don't have anything that corresponds the precious metals in the Global Macro Fund. You've said in the past that the portfolios partake of the same macro strategy, the same macro strategizing. So how do you account for the difference?
You know, it's a very subtle question, because part of it has to do with just accidents. For example, the asset allocation fund, at a time that we were looking at silver at gold bullion, and so the gold bullion would be a market that we wanted to be in, we had the opportunity to do that in the asset allocation fund only to buy gold miners. I say that because of liquidity considerations. We decided against buying miners for the Global Macro Fund, because it just didn't have the kind of liquidity we needed for the size of position that we needed to take on. Asian did. It remained sort of like an accident, and it stayed there. And the reason it stayed there is because it did well. It continued to do well, so there was no reason to liquidate that position. Whereas bullion, which by the way underperformed gold miners, we did get out a number of times. So one reason, and as I say, it's a function of almost accident. time of the day that when the decision was made. Generally speaking, when we say commodities, I believe that if you look at both funds' commodity position, if you say gold and silver are commodities, which they are, exposure is very similar, except that one asset allocation has it by way of more by way of precious metals, and the other one has it more by way of this Bloomberg commodity index. So they both partake of the same view, which is cheap, relatively cheap commodity prices should be moving up in this environment of a generalized upswing in commodity in economic activity. So and they should be moving up because we have had a very large increase in money, money supply over the past 10 years. So the idea is similar. The composition is a little bit different. Through the Bloomberg index, we are long gold but and silver, but in smaller proportions. So I would say that it does respond to the same economic view, macro view, which is commodity prices should rise. The composition of it is a little different, but in some of it, as I explained, has to do with accidents.
I see. Thank you. Let's change a bit to politics. You've said that you're not especially, you have no anxiety or no large anxiety preying upon you economically, but I know that you have political anxiety. You've got two very large out-of-the-money puts in the global macro fund, which you can't have in the asset allocation fund. They're on oil and on the Nikkei. Does that reflect your political anxiety?
Yes, both of them do. Political, military anxiety. Yes, and as I wrote in the past, the two hot spots today in the world are clearly North Korea and the Middle East and primarily Iran, and those are areas that can give us trouble and they can threaten the very, very delicate stability that we have at the moment. So they're unpredictable. We have no way to know when, if anything, will happen. We don't know whether North Korea will decide to send the missiles against South Korea and against Japan or even against U.S. forces. We don't know if it will, or we don't know what will cause them to do it. We don't know if the U.S. is planning a preemptive attack, and preemptive attacks are dangerous unless they're executed extremely well and very thoroughly. Same thing is true for Iran. There is a hardening of position against Iran at the moment. They're not living by the agreement. They're doing almost the same thing that Korea did from 1993 on, and which is build their nuclear capabilities and their delivery capabilities undercover in a way. So for that, we have taken some protection. We don't think that it would be sufficient. It would depend on what exactly happens, but there is some protection, which is we think that if anything happens in the Middle East, if there is an explosion there, oil prices are sure to rise very quickly, so we bought some out of the money calls, and we spent a little bit of money, but they're there, and of course they need to be renewed, and then each time we have to make that decision. And we also bought some puts on the out of the money puts on the Nikkei, and there it's not just because we are long the Nikkei, which we believe that it looks quite good, but also because it will have an effect on everything else, and so it can be reflected there. But in Japan, we have another risk, a second risk, and that risk has been there always. And the risk has to do with the possibility of a massive earthquake, and that can have an impact on a severe impact on economic activity. So for both reasons, we have purchased this protection and it sits there, and you might say you'll feel a little bit better because you have insurance. But you don't feel so good because it costs you money. And and then every time those things expire, those options expire, you have to make a new decision. Do you want to spend more money to do that?
Yeah, and likewise, I think it's sort of like buying
insurance fire insurance for your house or storm insurance for your house. Or
you don't want to collect.
Right.
Okay, two. Let's wind it up. Quick questions. I'm going to leave the Brazil one for the end. We had the French election on Sunday. We're going to they're going to the final round on 2 weeks from Sunday. You got a position in the Global Macro Fund, not in the Asset Allocation Fund, but in the Global Macro Fund, where Bob, you're betting on a widening between Italian and German credit. How do you think this election is going to play out as a result of the election there?
The French election already had an impact on those spreads. It had an impact on French spreads, which dropped 15 to 20 points. It had an impact also on Italian spreads, which also dropped close to 15 points. The question is whether Italy is different, and we believe Italy is different. Italy will probably have an election early next year. The feeling about wanting to be in the Eurozone or wanting to be part of the Euro system in it or wanting to be or wanting to have the Euro, let's say, in Italy is much weaker than it is in France. Polls indicate that only 41% of the people now like the euro, want to own euros. The Italian economic situation is nearly catastrophic. They have had no economic growth in the past 15 years, ever since they joined the euro. And they're just not able to take advantage of the euro because they have a very, very rigid labor force, among other problems. And so the Italians are likely at some point to reject the euro. And it's only a matter of time, and maybe the next election it will happen. We have a party that is bent on getting out of the euro and gaining popularity, run by a clown. But it will move in that direction. It's almost inevitable it will move in that direction. The position that we took actually was interesting because the position that we took was not based so much on the politics, even though we do believe the politics will move in our favor. The politics will move in the direction of getting out of the euro for Italy. But we took the position that interest rates in Europe rise, or as the ECB withdraws its stimulus into rise, even if it's a little bit, the rise in interest rates in Italy will be greater than the rise of interest rates in Germany. And therefore, the spreads will widen. And if there were no artificial measures and rates were free, totally free, the spread between Italy and Germany should rise 400 basis points, 500 or 600 basis points, given their financial condition. They have a very large debt. It's very difficult for them to pay it. And as rates rise, it sort of feeds on itself. As rates rise, it becomes even more difficult. So it's non-sustainable for them. The rising rates is the only reason why they survived in the last 3 or 4 years is because of intervention and because the ECB made it possible for them to pay low rates of interest, very low rates of interest. Had they continued to pay 4 or 5% a year, they would have been today already in default. And so we thought that the spread should work in our favor. And now, of course, we throw in the political situation, and that may accelerate this whole process. As far as France is concerned, we don't have a bet on France right now. You know, the existential question has been resolved, at least for the moment. It seems that Macron will win. But the real question, where is France going? What kind of reforms will it be able to implement? That remains very much up in the air. It will have to wait for the legislative elections coming up in June, and it's not very likely that he will have support, legislative support. He doesn't have a party. And so we may end up with a what's called the French curse, the cohabitation curse, which is a prime minister and a president of two different parties and at loggerheads with each other and no reform, nothing happening. And France badly needs reform. So longer term, France continues its long-term downtrend. But our bet is primarily in Italy, where we are fairly sure that the anti-euro sentiment is the strongest in Europe, and it's almost ready to be given up. And also, their debt level is much greater than much to the GDP than France's.
So let's wind it up with a little summary. Always a hot spot, always volatile. Things are moving along there. Temer's reforms have been partly accepted, partly not. He's negotiated with the states. Political situation in Latin America is always a bit scary. What's your take there?
He's continuing to do all he can and moving in the right direction. The pension reform is being watered down a little bit by Congress. They will retain anywhere between 60% and 70% of the original savings, and that's good. May give an occasion that maybe in the next few years they can do it again and then get some more savings out of it. But it's moving in the right direction, and a vote is coming up soon in the House, and then it will have to go to the other House. The Temer administration has negotiated with a lot of the states, the individual states that have very large amounts of debt and are not able to pay interest almost. So he's worked out some forbearance with them on their debt in exchange for very, very strong measures such as laying off extra people in the public sector that have too many and privatizing many companies. So that's good. That's a very good thing. Privatization in general is proceeding, and that's also very good at the federal level. So those things are happening. Interest rates remain still very high in real terms. The central bank's rate is about around 11% now, and inflation has come down to somewhere in the area of 2.5% per annum running on a running basis. 4.5% year over year, but on a running basis, 2.5. So interest rates remain very high. So we expect those rates to come down. We expect that ultimately the bonds that we own that are still yielding a little bit above 10% will trade somewhere down to 7% yield, and that still will produce a substantial result. They have done well. They will continue to do well. And the currency remains well bid. So we remain constructive, very constructive on Brazil.
Okay, thank you, Al. I have this nagging fear that I have not obeyed Eddie Roth's admonishment to name the date. In case that fear is justified, I'm going to restate it. Today is April 25th. Thank you very much for your time, Albert.
April 25th, 2017.
2017.
Right.
Thank you very much for your time. Albert, thank you very much for your time. Listeners, once again, our podcast or a transcript will be posted in the form of a podcast on the Freebird website and on the Niagara website to all and to Albert. My best wishes for a profitable trading quarter. Thanks again.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.